Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. We're in a doozy of an election right now, but we're not going to talk about it specifically this week. We will instead underscore that elections do have consequences by discussing what some of our elected officials in Sacramento, in the governor's office, and the state legislature have accomplished for LGBTQ rights this year. I'm joined by Bay Area reporter, assistant editor, and political columnist Matthew S. Bajeko to talk about pro-LGBTQ legislation Governor Gavin Newsom signed into law last month. This is the second in our new series of a monthly appearance by Matthew or another BAR journalist for a roundup of current political or other news affecting the queer community. Welcome back, Matthew.
Thanks for having me back, Eric.
Despite an unprecedented two-month break in this year's legislative session and a $54 billion budget deficit, both due to COVID-19, California lawmakers managed to send several LGBTQ equality measures to Governor Newsom for approval. These new laws, most of which are set to take effect next January 1st, include a bill requiring the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to house transgender, gender nonconforming, and intersex people according to their gender identity or their own perception of safety. A mandate to include LGBTQ status in COVID-19 data collection, effective immediately, and a measure ending discrimination against queer young people for consensual underage sex. For this last bill, its author, State Senator Scott Wiener, has received death threats and hate mail inspired by QAnon, the pro-Trump internet conspiracy theory. We'll get into some details of these new laws over the next 20 minutes or so, and if time allows, we'll also look at a couple bills that did not pass this year. Matthew S. Bajeko has been covering politics and other news for the Bay Area Reporter for 19 years. Matthew, so many folks have been focused on national politics and COVID-related news for the last few months, may not have been paying much attention to Sacramento. We're seeing COVID numbers spike across the country right now, although here in the Bay Area, we're looking okay for now, fingers crossed. One of the bills Newsom signed last month was SB 932, a measure that requires collection of gender identity and sexual orientation for all COVID-19 patients. Why did State Senator Scott Wiener and the LGBTQ caucus fight so hard for this bill?
Well, getting good data on the LGBTQ community has been a top goal for not only state legislators, but also LGBTQ advocacy groups for years. It's something that I've been reporting on at the paper. We use a shorthand for it called SOGI, which is sexual orientation, gender identity data. And the argument is that if you don't have the data, you don't know what's going on within the community health-wise. And it also hampers legislators and policymakers' ability to direct funding or resources to cover health crises within our community. So you're basically running blind. So that's why cities like San Francisco, the state of California, the state of New York, and other jurisdictions have made a real big push to start collecting the SOGI data. When COVID happened in March, I think a lot of people just assumed that the state and local health departments were already collecting the SOGI data because this bill had been passed years ago. The deadline for the state agencies to start implementing it was last summer. And lo and behold, they weren't collecting it. And the way that the computer systems are created that health officials use to collect this data, it's not automatically built in as a question. You know, they'll ask you about your age, your race, your sex, you know, all these other questions, but they don't ask you, are you gay, bi, lesbian, trans, queer, you know, those types of things. And so really for months now, we have no idea how badly the state's LGBT community has been impacted by COVID. And to this day, we still do not. I have yet to see the state health officials put out any data on this. It's unclear to me if these questions are even being asked. My husband and I recently went in to get tested by the city here in San Francisco, and neither one of us were asked if we were gay men. So I don't really know if this information is being collected yet. It's something that we're trying to track down. And
that collection was supposed to start immediately upon Governor Newsom's signature, right?
And, you know, if you look at the information that the state health department has been putting out ever since, It's just not in there. And this is why they wanted him to do an executive order back in the spring to start get this ball rolling. Because it's, even though the governor, the state health officials said they supported collecting this data, it's not easy. And what I have found in reporting on this over the years is that you need to train people how to ask the question. We all know that issues around sexuality are still uncomfortable for a lot of people, even people who may be progressive and work in the health industry. It's just not something they're used to asking patients about. And if you don't ask the questions properly, that hesitancy or ick factor, which you may not even realize is coming through your tone, can be signaled to the person you're asking the question of. And you know, if you look at initially, like, who was being impacted by COVID, it was seniors. Well, seniors in the LGBTQ community are still not used to being asked to divulge this information. So even if you're talking with an LGBTQ person, there's a reluctance there to even give out this information. And for various reasons, you know, they grew up in a time frame where just even being gay had repercussions that people today just couldn't even imagine, like being kicked out of your housing, your job. You know, that does happen still, sadly, throughout the country in certain states. But here in California, it's just not something you really see or hear about often. But even as a journalist for a gay newspaper, when I ask people how they identify, I get a whole range of responses. Where people are getting more used to it, I think, and it's not as a go-to reaction of, well, why do you need to know that? I think people understand why an LGBT newspaper this day and age is asking that, because we want to ensure the diversity of our community is reflected in our coverage. And if you don't ask people how they identify, you just can't tell that. You know, and we want to make sure our readers know we're not just interviewing gay men or white lesbians, and that, you know, the bisexual and trans and queer community are represented in our stories. And you have to ask that question, right? So this was why it was such a big deal to get the state to start collecting this data.
And were some health professionals, like in some counties, also resisting having to ask that question because they felt like it was a potential violation of privacy rights? Well, is that one of the things that had to be addressed to change the language to make this bill pass?
It's not so much the privacy rights. I think it was just that they're under, you know, duress trying to just, you know, switch on a dime to try to tackle this horrible disease that has, you know, came out of nowhere, has ravaged communities up and down the state, and they're already strapped trying to deal with, you know, getting the right protective material for healthcare workers, frontline workers, you know, just trying to set up triage, all these other things. And so this is like one other headache they're not, you know, maybe set up to do, because their computer systems don't have this in there. And, you know, you think, well, it's going to be an easy thing. Well, it's not. You know, they're contracted to use certain systems, and those companies are the ones that they have to go and request that they update. So I get it. I understand why it's not an easy fix that health departments can make. But you would think that this shouldn't have gotten to the point where it required a law to be passed. But you know, that's just the way that it ended up working out. And it's certainly something we're going to be tracking to see if it's being carried out now that the governor signed the bill.
Okay, so listeners, the next time you go for a COVID test and they don't ask you what your sexual orientation is, give us a call. Well, yeah, give Matthew a call or an email, whatever.
Exactly.
Because it's supposed to be in effect immediately upon a signature, which was the end of September, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. That's all we need to say about that one for the moment. So two of the LGBTQ-related bills signed by the governor were held over from last year. Those were both also authored by State Senator Scott Wiener. So let's start with the more controversial of those two, Senate Bill 145. This bill, starting next January 1st, ends the state's current practice of treating queer young people differently than their hetero peers for engaging in consensual sex with an underage partner. Currently, I'm phrasing here, simplifying, state law requires judges to place such individuals in the sex offender registry while not requiring the same for hetero individuals or pairs, perhaps I should say. So give us the basics, Matthew. What will this law do?
So it does not change any criminal statutes, but what it does do is, one, it allows judges the flexibility to treat LGBTQ youth the same as their heterosexual counterparts. Because right now, straight people who are, you know, caught with an underage partner are not automatically forced to go on to the sex registry. But if you're a lesbian or a gay kid or youth and you have a partner who's not of the legal age, you're automatically forced to go onto the sex registry if you're brought up on charges. So this bill definitely has been also very hard for, I think, people to message around. When it was first introduced, the gay rights groups basically stopped sending out press releases because the coverage in the mainstream press was so bad. And I think they just got to the point where, you know, we've tried to explain this and we're still getting bad headlines and bad coverage that just doesn't get it. And that's carried over to this year. And it combined where the, you know, followers of the QAnon picked it up and just completely just misrepresented what the bill was going to do, attacked its author. It's now being used as a attack against another one of its supporters down in San Diego, gay assemblyman Todd Gloria, who is, you know, looking to be on track to be elected as their first out elected mayor. But his opponents have been using his support of this bill to try to chip away at his support down there. And, you know, quite frankly, it really isn't going to change the law other than to just make it a little more fair in these cases where you have, you know, partners where one of the partner is underage, but their partner really is not that much older than them. And if it's consensual, I mean, we're not talking about a rape case here. We're talking about, you know, people who have been dating are in a romantic relationship, but still legally are considered to be going against the law because one of them isn't over 18.
So for example, an 18-year-old high school senior who has a boyfriend or girlfriend who is, you know, a year, who's 17.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they can, and he can. He, if they, excuse me, the 18-year-old, whether it's a boy or a girl, can get on the sex offender registry for life, which is,
right,
I guess, really hard to get off of.
It is hard. You know, Senator Wiener was able to pass a bill several years ago that made it easier for people to ask to be taken off after a certain time on the registry, but. But still, I mean, when you think, when you actually just sit back and think about the reality of dating, you know, you have people in college, in high school, mingling for various reasons, you know, so we're talking about people in their late teens, early 20s, and, you know, in the straight community, that's not seen as something wrong if, you know, a senior in college is dating a senior in high school. But because of the negativity surrounding gay sexuality, and particularly this comes up with gay men more so than with lesbian women, you know, we as gay men have had to fight the stigma that we're pedophiles, that we're, you know, going after younger boys. And this has nothing to do with it at all. It's about people in romantic relationships who make their own decisions to date people, and then they get, you know, called out by their parents who are homophobic, or a relative, or whoever it is. They get reported to the police, and this triggers this unfair legal precedent that they have to experience that straight people do not. And that's what this law addressed. And that's why the governor signed it and supported it, and it had support of, you know, district attorneys and different law enforcement groups throughout the state, because they knew that it was an unfair policy, basically.
Yes, and yet, so on the day it was signed, after it was signed on September 11th, I believe, this Republican Southern California Senator Melissa Melendez tweeted, "Oh, well, what a shock. Newsom signed SB 145, the bill that allows a 24-year-old to have sex with a 14-year-old and escape a felony conviction and requirement to be on a registered sex offender list. Absolutely disgusting." So that's actually, I guess the germ of what she's saying there is true, that the age range can be 10 years. But that's the way it is for straight couples as well, correct?
Right.
So it just makes it even.
Right.
Scott Weiner did... Go ahead.
Right. And if it's not a consensual relationship, then the judge has the discretion to move forward with the charging of the person who's the older partner in the relationship. So it does absolutely nothing if it is a predatory relationship, then the person can still be held accountable and forced to register as a sex offender. But this takes out the automatic derailment of gay and lesbian young people's lives.
Okay, very good. And the last thing I'll say about it is just to mention that Scott Weiner had an op-ed in the New York Times last week. And in it, he mentions that he at one point asked his interns to stop answering the phones because he was getting, you know, death threats, you know, hourly or more often than that. So they just had to stop for a while to let things calm down. And hopefully they have. You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen, speaking with Matthew S. Bajeko, assistant editor and politics columnist for the Bay Area Reporter, about bills Governor Newsom has signed into law that will help protect LGBTQ people's rights in California. So let's move on now to SB 132. This measure ensures that the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitations, that's the folks who run state prisons, will house incarcerated transgender, gender nonconforming, and intersex people based on their gender identity, unless that person believes they're safer in another housing placement. So first of all, a little background, what are some of the dangers that transgender people have faced in prison?
So right now, it does not matter how you identify your gender. If you're assigned as male at birth, even though you are now a woman, in prison, you are assigned to a male facility. And that opens up these female inmates who are trans to harassment, rape, discrimination by employees, and it's just a very horrific environment that they are put into, with, you know, until now, really no way to get out of it. So starting next year, inmates who want to be relocated to a facility that matches their gender identity can petition the prison officials to be relocated. The governor just named a new head of the prison system. It's the first woman to run it. And she had been working on this bill with Senator Weiner's office and the LGBT groups that were behind it. So there is support within the state prison system for implementing this policy.
Okay, fair enough. Let's talk about the Transgender Wellness and Equity Fund. That's another bill, a law that goes into effect from Assembly Bill 2218. What's that about?
Well, sadly, it's a law that has no oomph to it anymore, and that's largely due to COVID, but it's now there so that moving forward, hopefully it can actually get some funding to it. So earlier in the year, it looked like it was going to sail through and create this $15 million fund to pay for various trans health services and other services throughout the state, but then COVID hit. The state's facing, you know, multi-million dollar deficit, and they had to pare down bills. Anything that wasn't directly related to COVID and had a lot of funding attached to it was pretty much, you know, stalled, thrown out, held over till next legislative session. And this is one of those bills that looked like was dead on arrival when the legislature came back earlier this summer. But the transgender community rallied, and the author of the bill worked with his colleagues to get it through. they agreed to take out the funding requirement so that hopefully just by creating the fund going forward, there's an argument, well, we have this, now let's fund it, right? So
they don't have to fight the whole battle all over again.
Exactly.
Next year when the finances improve.
Right. Okay. So next year we'll be looking to see through the appropriations process if they can get some funding and what specific services will get funded through it.
Okay, great. Before we talk about a couple of bills that didn't quite make it through this year, is there any other ones you want to mention that that are going into effect in January?
Well, another big one that kind of went under the radar just because of everything that's been going on is this SB 961, the Equal Insurance HIV Act. It was sponsored by Senator Lena Gonzalez of Long Beach and had the backing of Gay State Insurance Commissioner Ricardo Lara. And basically, it just means that people who are HIV positive will no longer be able to be denied health insurance and life insurance based on their living with HIV or AIDS, which is huge. It's unclear how big of an issue this has been, but I think it's also one of those things where it could have become an even bigger issue as more people who are HIV positive or living with AIDS age. So, you know, as San Francisco has seen and California has seen and now the rest of the country has seen, the population of people who are HIV positive is rapidly aging. I mean, in San Francisco, the majority of cases are people 55 plus. Those people back, you know, 20 years ago, they didn't even think they were going to live to see 55, 60, 65. They weren't thinking about buying, you know, disability insurance or life insurance. And now when they are starting to like, oh, you know, I could possibly live until I'm 80, 90, 100, and they want to buy these policies, they will not be denied solely because they're HIV positive. So it's a big, big change. And especially for people who unfortunately are younger and contracting HIV, you know, in their 20s, who also probably aren't thinking about buying life insurance or disability insurance, when they do go to buy that, they can't be denied here if they're living in California. Hopefully also, the other important thing is that once a state like California enacts policies like this, usually we see other states across the country take these laws and pass them themselves. So it bodes well for people across the country who may have been dealing with this issue. Here's a bill that lawmakers in their state can take and maybe get through their legislature as well.
Okay, fantastic. So let's talk just for a few minutes about a couple of things that didn't quite make it this year. One is a bill, Senate Bill 201. This legislation was intended to postpone surgeries on intersex infants until they're at least 6 years old. But the bill failed to pass its Senate committee earlier this year. What's behind that?
Well, once again, this is one of those bills where it is, one, hard to explain to lawmakers who have never encountered an intersex person in their life and may not know much about it, because intersex people don't, until recently, really have not gotten a lot of attention. Today, the day we're taping this interview, just so happens to be Intersex Awareness Day, which is something that they created to address that very issue of just a lack of awareness around intersex people and what health issues they're dealing with. And basically what it is that babies born with the sexes or the genitals of both sexes. And a lot of the times what ends up happening is that the parents and the doctors decide what they want the infant's sex to be. And they will perform a surgery on that infant to make that happen. And then, you know, when the infant grows up and then learns and discovers this, they might object to that. And so the intention of this bill is really to delay that decision-making process until the intersex person is old enough to engage in that conversation and have some buy-in, which, you know, is within, and encapsulates a lot of issues that make it controversial. So one, rights of parents to make decisions for their children. The advice of doctors and what procedures doctors are allowed to do. So it had a lot of opposition from medical groups here in the state that were concerned about, you know, taking their ability away to make those decisions, you know, in conversation with parents. But since this bill it got tabled in the legislature, so Senator Wiener, I just spoke with him today to check in, and they are looking at bringing this back probably next legislative session in January.
Okay, very good. We got into more details than I thought we would about several of these bills. You can make legislation interesting, Matthew.
Well, if I can quickly just get in one more bill, even if it makes it on the cutting room floor.
Okay, so go ahead.
Another bill to be looking for also has to do with people's documents. And this one was also 86 this year because of COVID. Just didn't make it. But Assemblyman David Chu out of San Francisco, he had introduced a bill called AB 2023 that would prevent the state's public colleges and universities from using students' dead names on their diplomas. So that's where, you know, a student enrolls in college, realizes that they're trans, changes their name, and you know, they transition their gender, but when they graduate, the school on the diploma uses their dead name, the name they were given at birth that they're probably not using anymore. And the issue there, once again, is if they submit their college diploma or college records to employers, and the employer is thinking that they're talking with a woman, but then they have documents that all refer to a man, it's outing that person as trans, and sure, maybe they don't want to be outed in that manner. So that's definitely a bill that his office says that they expect they're going to carry probably next year as well.
You can learn more about these new laws and other statewide LGBTQ news by visiting the Bay Area Reporter website at ebar.com, that's ebar.com, or pick up a copy of the print edition at a bookstore or newsstand near you. My guest today was Matthew Espejako, assistant editor and politics columnist for the Bay Area Reporter, Northern California's largest circulation LGBTQ newspaper and online news service. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you, Eric.
We're really happy about our new partnership with the Bay Area Reporter. We'll have a short article on the BAR's website every Friday with a link to our feature for the week. So check it out. And once a month, Matthew or another BAR editor or writer will comment out in the Bay to fill us in on important stories in the queer community. Be sure to visit outinthebay.org, where you can also hear this show again, hear past shows, and share them with friends. You can also sign up for our weekly e-news, please do, and subscribe to our podcasts. Growing numbers could help us secure funding. So pass it around. We're always open to donations too. Just hit the donate button on our website. Once again, it's outinthebay.org. I want to thank my co-producers, Drew Gwynn and Kendra Klang. Hey, would you like to join our team? There are many ways we could use your talents in audio production, social media, program distribution, fundraising, and more. Let us know how you might be able to help. If things go well, volunteer help could become paid. If you're interested, please write to us, outinthebaysf@gmail.com. That's outinthebaysf@gmail.com. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening, thanks for voting, and thanks for joining us out in the Bay.